Music City, Nashville, Tennessee.
Two guys fumbling their way through the music business so you don't have to. Here they are. It's Scott and it's Hino and the Music Row Show.
All right, welcome back to the Music Row Show. We're so glad you're back with us. You can chime in with the conversation on Facebook.com/TheMusicRowShow or on Twitter at TheMusicRowShow. Hashtag TMRS.
That is right. And did you already say Twitter, Instagram?
I did.
You got all that?
Yeah.
Oh, and did you tell them about the past shows on the podcast?
No, you go for it.
Okay, you can always listen to past shows by clicking the podcast page on TheMusicRowShow.com.
That is so true.
It's very cool.
And you know what? We did just in the last week or so, we launched our Instagram account finally. We've got like 4 pictures on there now. So, but we're going to be adding a whole lot more. So go ahead and...
The whole town's talking
about
it.
Oh, I know. Follow us on
Instagram,
too.
Talking about the big Instagram.
You never know what you're going to see.
Okay, nobody's really talking about it. I'm sorry.
But
they will now.
Now that Mary's here, she's
take a picture of that.
Well, we can just tweet each other incessantly and
Make
it look like people care.
That's right. That's right.
I retweeted the tweet.
Did you retweet?
Yeah, actually, and a lot of people retweeted that retweet.
Well, you see,
it's a tweet fest.
You know, just hang around long enough and it'll catch on.
You know, I think, I'm learning about this whole Twitter thing. I'm pretty excited. Well, Hino, who's this wonderful person sitting with us tonight?
Well, we are so excited to be visiting with performing songwriter, recording artist Mary Gaucher. Now, I don't want to give away too much here in the intro, but Mary's story is going to amaze you. Abandoned as an infant, adopted, becomes a runaway, goes to jail, goes to culinary school, opens an award-winning restaurant in Boston, chucks it all to be a songwriter, has a hit with her first two albums, Dixie Kitchen and Drag Queens and Limousines, gets named Best New Artist of the Year by the Americana Music Association, and you know what? That's just the beginning. So we're so glad. We've been trying to get her on for years. We're delighted that you're here with us. Mary Gaucher, welcome to the Music Row Show.
It's good to see y'all. Yeah.
You left out the chemistry. Didn't you discover a new element or something like that, too?
I'm not sure. What are you referring to?
I'm making it up as I go along. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Let's talk real then. I watched a 20-year-old Bob Dylan interview, and he described growing up as never feeling he was supposed to be where he was and that he was always going towards something, but he didn't know what it was. And then I heard an interview of yours, and you said something very, very similar. What drove you as a young person?
That was so long ago. I don't remember.
Okay.
As an older person, however, I think what drove me as a young person was one thing: fear.
Okay. And then, going to Boston, did that start dissipating that fear, getting out of where you were? Because I know that that whole New Orleans area is kind of a strange place, especially if it's not.
Well, it can be problematic if you're an alcoholic.
And right.
It can be even worse if you're a drug addict, and I, of course, am both.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found the whole thing to be a little overwhelming, and I needed to get out of there. You know, for me, the process of getting older has been incredibly relieving because I'm just not, I don't experience the fear as much.
Yeah.
I hardly experience it at all. I was just so scared when I was young. I don't even know what I was scared of, but I was afraid all the time.
Right.
And, you know, it has a lot to do with the chemistry of addiction and addictionology. I'm sure it has to do with being in an orphanage as a kid, and has to do with being adopted by people who I didn't really fit with. But ultimately, I think a lot of young people are afraid.
Yeah.
And in the bravado and the arrogance, I think, behind it, if you dig a little bit, is fear.
Mm-hmm. I just saw a video this week of you, and you were addressing young people and just saying, it gets better.
Oh, you saw the it gets better, huh?
Yeah.
I really like talking to young people, especially young people that have gotten into some trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the message, is that it does get better. Like, don't do yourself in yet. Just hang on for a little while.
Sure, yeah.
As you get older, this thing improves because you have more information about how you fit in the scheme of things in this big, intimidating world.
Nice. Wow.
Well, speaking of getting better, I mean, you eventually did go to culinary school, and you opened a great restaurant, Dixie Kitchen, in Boston, that was rocking along for about 11 years or so.
Yeah, we had a great run.
Yeah. And then you decided, okay, I'm done with this. I'm going to go be a songwriter and a recording artist. Talk about that transition and what was the impetus to leave that life behind and pursue a brand new one?
Well, you know, I'm a person of faith, and I believe that people and things get put in your path for a reason a lot. Mm-hmm. And if you can... you can get in touch with that, a destiny will unfold that's beyond your wildest dreams. Oddly, my restaurant was right next door to Berklee College of Music. Oh. And so when I went to hire people, it was students at Berklee. And when I opened the doors, it was faculty and students at Berklee. I was just surrounded by musicians.
Right.
Opening night of the restaurant, I was arrested for drunk driving. It wasn't my first arrest, and it certainly wasn't my first time to drive drunk. But that night in that little holding cell, I had an epiphany. And I left my body, and I saw myself for what had to be less than a second. But that was all it took. I saw it, and that was July 13th, 1990. I haven't had a drink or a drug since.
Wow. What did you see?
I saw terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair, helplessness, and hopelessness. And I saw someone who needed to ask for help, to plug into something much bigger than me, to get me out of the hole I had dug for myself. And that was the beginning of the whole new life. And so, this is a long answer to a short question. It took 10 years for me to heal and become the person that I would have been if I wasn't an addict. Hmm. And so, the 10 years in the restaurant, I was healing. I was getting my ability to read back. I had done myself in. It's so funny. I could open a restaurant, but I surely couldn't write a song.
Really?
I mean, I could run a restaurant, but I couldn't read a book. Restaurants are crazy, you know?
Oh, yeah.
They're crazy. And crazy people do well in restaurants.
Yes.
You know? If you're manic and nuts and multitasking and angry and propelled by self-will... to me, that's the definition of a restaurateur. We're crazy people, right? You just do 1,000 things, and the one thing you don't do well is sit back quietly and have peace. Mm-hmm. Because it's 1,000 things to do at all times. And so I was pretty good at it, but I couldn't be an artist. And so I had to slow down, find my voice, find my my heart, find... faith and direction, and I had to learn how to listen, and I learned to learn how to pray, and I became calmer, and as I did, I started connecting with the songwriters that worked for me.
Okay. Now, had you done any writing in your life before that, or was that...
I would sit down. This is a good segue to your original question.
Okay.
I thought the right combination of chemicals in front of me, done over the right amount of minutes or hours, would lead to a great song.
Okay.
So I was a chemist, and I came up with nothing, absolutely nothing, but utter frustration. I could not write songs under the influence of drugs and alcohol. Mm-hmm. And it astonishes me the great songs that are still being written in that way.
Yeah.
By other people, not me. You know, I think Dylan wrote some of his best stuff on Benzedrine.
Yeah.
Sort of Johnny Cash. And I cannot write anything at all because I'm an addict. I'm not able to do it in a way that has a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Okay.
It has a beginning, and then God knows what's going to happen. So I can't focus, you know. So my songs started coming as I got clean and was able to write them. And so what was the question?
Well, as you started connecting with your employees, with the songwriters that were working there, how were those initial connections? Were you saying, hey, I'd like to write with you, or how did you make that?
No, I didn't. Oh, no, I wasn't able to say so then what I was were you a doing? Songwriter at that point.
Okay.
It took great courage for me to say it, to put it out in the universe. I was very good at self-destruction, but to reveal my heart's desires, I felt so incredibly vulnerable.
So then how were you connecting with him? In what way?
Well, they were all songwriters, and they all had different dreams and hopes, you know. But the one that got me was a songwriter. I still remember her name, and this was 20 years ago, 25 years ago. Her name is Christy Zarlango, and she invited me to go to an open mic at Club Passim in Harvard Square, arguably the oldest folk club in the United States of America.
Mm-hmm.
And the open mic is much like what writers' nights are here in Nashville.
Sure.
Young writers, not necessarily young chronologically or age-wise, but writers who haven't got a career yet.
Right.
Go and play original songs. You put your name in a hat, they draw your name, and you wait 2.5 hours to play for 3.5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
and she brought me, and I remember they said, we're going to do this like Nashville. We're going to do Writers in the Round. And this is how it's done in Nashville, Tennessee. And I was like, whoa. It was like the curtains opened, and I saw what was in my heart and what was in my soul. And she played her song, and it made a big impression on me that she played her song, you know. And I had never seen people at entry level do entry level songs.
Right.
I've gone to hundreds of shows, but not entry level.
Right.
Not at the beginning. I didn't know there wasn't.
So then you realize that there you could.
Yeah,
be a beginner.
This is how it's done. You start at the beginning with all the other beginners, and you wait 2.5 hours to play 3.5 minutes, and you're terrible at it.
Yeah.
And then you wait another week and do it again. Yeah. And you get about just a millimeter better.
Yeah.
You know, and then you go home and beat yourself up for all the things you could have done better, and you wait another week and you do it again.
Yeah.
And then I started finding open mics around town. When I saw Christy play her song, I knew that I had to go home and write a song and do it. I'd always wanted to do it, but I hadn't had the focus or the presence or the confidence or the... I wasn't free from fear enough to do it. I needed to get out of that prison of fear. And man, the first time I got up there, I can tell you, I was outside of time. Everything slowed to a halt. And I was so afraid that all the spit evaporated from my mouth. I could have literally blown dust out of my... I was absolutely terrified, and it was I wasn't any good at it, and it was one of the most important moments of my life.
Wow!
Because I did it.
Do you remember any of that first song?
No.
Yeah.
I just remember the terror.
Okay.
And I remember that it's really hard to speak when you don't have any spit in your mouth.
Yeah.
And try singing.
Yeah,
you know,
so, yeah.
It's like a dog with peanut butter, right? But worse. Way worse.
So the actual mechanics of writing a song, how did you figure that out? Was it just instinctive, or did you go get books, or how did you figure that out?
I grew up in libraries. It was the one safe place when I was a kid. So I'd have my mom drop me off at the library. And when I wasn't at school on Saturdays, I'd have her drop me off at the library when it opened and pick me up when it closed. Totally a word person. And then I became a song lover. And I was always drawn to singer-songwriters. And I was always drawn to singer-songwriters whose words were utterly beautiful. The poets, you know, the Coens, the Dylans, the Joni Mitchell, Neil Young, the people who spoke to my generation through poem and melody, the singer-songwriters.
Right.
So I came in with a passion for it. I didn't know how to do it, but I knew how I loved it. And then I just started modeling what I was doing after the artist that I loved, which I think is the typical trajectory.
Sure.
You do imitations.
Sure.
You know, here's Mary doing Steve Earle. You know, here's Mary doing her best Merle. You know, and here's Mary doing Johnny Cash. And here's Mary doing her very best Lucinda Williams. And eventually, I found my voice. But I think you have to start at the beginning, and you don't know what your voice is, so you imitate your heroes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Then eventually there's Mary doing Mary.
And if you hang around long enough, there's people imitating Mary.
Yeah.
Which is the ultimate flattery.
When
nice. People get paid, you know, I've forever been compared to other people, and now other people being compared to me, and I laugh. Like, that means I'm old. I have the persistence to have been allowed the opportunity to continue in this road long enough for other people to start to be compared to me.
Wow. Well, that is awesome.
Here's to being old. We're right there with you. Let's take a break. We're going to be back with much more with Mary Gauthier. You're listening to The Music Row Show. Stick around.
Corey died last night, his wife Wanda by his side. He caught the westbound out of here, hopped the high irons to the by and by.
All right, welcome back to the Music Row Show. We are on with recording artist Mary Gaucher, and that's a tune called Last of the Hobo Kings off of her brand new project, Live
at
Blue Rock.
Mm-hmm. And where can people buy this CD? Everywhere?
Oh, yeah, marygaucher.com. Good luck spelling it.
We'll help them. Gaucher.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's everywhere. Amazon, iTunes, you know.
It's dynamite. Dynamite. Pick it up. Live at Blue Rock. There it is on your TV screen. Talk about how you started talking about this as you were in the library and you were such a lover of words, and also mm-hmm. you gravitated towards certain musicians. So there was important music for you as you were growing up. And I'm wondering, based on everything I've heard from you, if you feel a sense of responsibility to the people that, that will be listening to you. It seems like you really, I don't even know what I'm trying to say other than you clearly loved the words as a listener. And I think that you really make it a huge priority in your music, not just to you, but also to the people listening. Is that?
I think so. I feel a responsibility to the truth.
Mm-hmm.
To be honest. And one of the challenges of songwriting is that generally when I sit down to write a song and I feel as though there's a thread to pull and make a song up about it, I don't know what the truth is about it. Mm-hmm. I have to find it. And so it's a real challenge. It's finding the truth inside me and then making it rhyme. You know, Harlan Howard was no dummy.
Yeah.
When people laugh at the three chords and the truth thing, but let me tell you something about three chords and the truth. It's about the hardest way there is to write.
Mm-hmm.
Because simple has to be utterly compelling to really be the truth.
Because you can't hide behind fancy. Like you said, if you try to get too fancy with it.
There's no greater songwriter, and there'll never be a greater songwriter than Hank Williams.
Yeah.
Simple.
Yeah.
Simple. But hitting on universal truths and universal struggle and universal joy, he nailed the human condition mm-hmm. with his simplicity. Very, very hard to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, when Cash was asked advice about songwriting, he always said, write simple, kid. It's the hardest thing you'll ever do.
Yeah. Wow. Well, we'd love to hear a song if you feel like playing one.
You got it. Well, he'd get home at 5:30. He'd fix his drink and sit down in his chair. Pick a fight with Mama. Complain about us kids getting in his hair. At night he'd sit alone and smoke. I'd see his frown behind his lighter's flame. Now that same frown's in my mirror. I got my daddy's blood inside my veins. Fish swim, birds fly, daddy's yell, mama's cry, old men sit and think. Chicken TV dinner, 6 minutes on defrost, 3 on high. beer to wash it down with, another, then some whiskey on the side. It ain't so bad alone here. It don't bother me that every night's the same. I don't need another lover hanging around trying to make me change. Fish swim, birds fly, lovers leave by and by. Old men sit and think. I drink, I know what I am. But I don't. Give a damn. Fish swim. Birds fly. Dead as yell. Mamas cry. Old men didn't think. I drink.
Wow.
Woo.
Wow, wow, wow. Well, Rob, you're kind of speechless.
You know what's weird is I wrote that 5 years sober.
Yeah?
I couldn't have written that when I was drinking.
Man.
I wouldn't have had the perspective.
Well, I was reading about your early recording process and some of the producers that you worked with, and you said something very interesting. You said that the slightest eyebrow raise from a producer could just make you crumble in the studio. Talk about that and what it is that producers do that maybe they don't even know what they do, and how do you work with that as an artist?
Well, for the listening audience who may not know what a producer is, in a recording process, a producer is sort of the team captain first pick.
Mm-hmm.
He or she is the one who makes the final decisions and who is guiding. I hire a producer to guide me to my best.
Okay.
And for me, you know, sometimes early on, maybe I would want to bring players in that were my friend, and the producer would say, you know, friends are great, but we want players that can really translate in the studio.
Yeah.
So it helped me make good decisions and helped me with the songs before we record them. The person who produces the record will say, that song needs a fix right there. That's not, I don't believe that. Or that melody lays flat. Or that line doesn't, it just is not in the right order. I mean, you're losing me there.
Right.
You know, so we work on the songs. But really, for me, I'm vulnerable in the studio because I don't know if it's good yet.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't had the applause yet. I don't know. And so I need someone very gentle, very kind. If I'm horrible, I need someone to say, that was fantastic. Try it again.
Yeah.
If I get I'm done. Yeah.
That's it. Because then you're so stressed and trying so hard.
It's like putting steroids or lighter fluid on my insecurities.
Right.
So I need a positive, encouraging person that's going to say, man, that was great. Do it again. It could be even better. Like, I need to be uplifted. I don't do well being told that wasn't good. I freak out. I do. I'm insecure in that way in the studio for sure.
You said something really interesting in that you say you haven't heard the applause. You don't know if it's good yet. So you don't take songs out to road test them for a while before you record them?
It's a problem. It's a problem with YouTube. I play, people shoot it, and next thing you know, the whole world hears it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a problem because if I'm working it out in front of people like I used to.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense, yeah.
That's broadcast all over the world.
Right.
And so, I don't bring out my new songs that much.
That's interesting.
I never thought of that, but that, yeah.
Because I'll play a song live, and that's when I realize where all the kinks are. I can play it 100 times on my couch, and it sounds great. But you play it in an audience, you go, oh, that doesn't work, or that doesn't work. But when you get to a point where people are actually filming you, that thing that doesn't work, that's how the song is now.
There's more technology in this toy than there was in the first rocket ship that went to the moon.
Yeah.
A button, and a button later, and send, and the entire world just saw me fall on my face with a new song that wasn't ready yet. So mm-hmm. I'm really careful about, I will play new songs out before I record them, but I'm real careful about where and when. And okay. I will ask people not to. And it's kind of a buzzkill. You're at a show, and like, I got a new song, and I really want to play it, and I need everybody to turn off the cameras now. It's like, that's not done feeling like a great show, right?
Yeah,
it's like,
right.
Well, Miss Pris, exactly. I'll turn off the camera. You know, so it's just a weird time. Everything's so simultaneous. I think pretty soon it won't matter because we'll just be giving these away, and they'll be the ad to get people to the show.
Yeah.
Which ain't so bad. I mean, I used to own a restaurant, and we've talked about this in the show. I know what an ad costs. You know, an ad this size in the Boston Globe, one single run would be $5,000.
Right.
And what's in one town?
Right.
One paper, one town. So, you know, you make one of these for $30,000, $40,000, or $50,000, give them away to the world as an ad, get people to the show. That's not the end of the world.
Boy, that's an interesting way to look at it. I mean, and that's where it's going. That's where it's going.
That is very, very interesting.
Wow. You mentioned Harlan a little while ago.
Love Harlan Howard.
And you, when you came to Nashville, you ended up writing for his publishing.
I did.
Tell us about that.
I did. I came to town looking for Harlan Howard.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, part of my process as a songwriter was to take songwriting workshops.
Mm-hmm.
And I took some with Ralph Murphy.
Mm. Aha. Okay. Our very first guest
Murphy's
ever.
Laws. Yeah.
Murphy's Law.
Let's do a little plug for Ralph Murphy's songwriting book. It's called Murphy's Laws. And Murphy's a great songwriting teacher and a wonderful songwriter with several beautiful hits under his belt. He became a bit of a mentor to me. And he always would talk about Harlan Howard and Harlan Howard. So I came to town looking for Harlan Howard.
Mm-hmm.
And he had died 4 months prior.
Mm.
And I didn't know that. So I just, you know, I called Murphy. I said, you got to get me a meeting at Harlan's publishing company. So I met with Melanie Howard, his widow.
Mm-hmm.
And I played that song. I just played You. And I got her attention. And it became a wonderful working relationship. She got me that song. She got it cut. She got Blake to cut that song. And she, you know, she ran me up and down Music Row. And I ended up with a record deal. And I ended up meeting people I couldn't believe I was sitting in the room with. Like my third time at that office, I was sitting in the room with Merle Kilgore.
Wow. Wow.
And
what do you even do?
Yeah.
We're talking about juice fasting is what we did because he had just been diagnosed with cancer.
Mm-hmm. Oh, boy.
You know, And he was trying to you know, find some holistic way of staying around a little longer.
Yeah.
And so we got to talking about something normal. I mean, I can't talk songwriting with Merle Kilgore, you know.
Right.
So we talked about holistic health and you know, he put down the drinking and he wanted to live. And so if you want to talk about being healthy and not killing yourself, I can talk about that. And if you want to talk about being self-destructive and completely insane, I could talk about that too.
You got both sides covered.
You are just a, yeah.
I know.
Awesome.
Yeah, now that the fear is lifted, I'm not afraid to talk about either one. But it was a wonderful thing to go there because it fits. She kept saying, it feels like Harlan reincarnated in a lesbian body. Like, I feel like I'm talking to some dyke Harlan. I'm like, well, you know, I think that's a compliment.
Wow.
I'll take it.
All right. Well, we're going to take a break on that note. But we're going to be back with a whole lot more with Mary Gaucher. Mary, by the way, you're doing really well. Keep it up. Keep doing what you're doing.
Fantastic.
You're doing fantastic. And we're going to be back in just a few minutes on the Music Row Show. All right, welcome back to the Music Row Show.
Cane smoke ain't no good for you when you breathe it in every day.
We are here with recording artist Mary Gaucher, and that's a tune called Sugarcane off a brand new project, Live at Blue Rock. And we were just talking right before we went to break about your time with over at Harlan Howard's company.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that after he died, you were kind of given access to a big treasure trove of his unfinished songs. What did you do with that? I mean, that's amazing.
Well, it was scary, first of all. It was scary because he handed me a guitar that that Chet Atkins had had for 12 years.
Oh, man.
One of Harlan's guitars that Chet liked, and so Chet had recorded with it. And then when Chet passed, the guitar went back over to the office. And so here's Harlan's unfinished lyrics and Chet Atkins' guitar. Welcome to Nashville, kid.
Wow. No pressure.
Like, oh, I'm okay. All right, what do you do with that? Harlan would write when he went to the bar to drink.
Mm-hmm.
He'd write on bar napkins,
mm-hmm,
with a felt tip pen, so it would kind of just kind of run, you know. So it was kind of you had to decipher, and it was a big box of stuff that had been saved from his desk drawers and his, you know, the bureau, top of the bureau and stuff. And so I just went through the piles and tried to find stuff I could pull from. He didn't leave a lot of good stuff behind, I have to tell you. If he had a good idea, he wrote it. But there's stuff, you know. There's stuff. I'm still figuring out what to do about that. That's my next thing, actually.
Okay.
That's my next thing.
Well, you said earlier that once you realized that writing was your thing, you started going to an awful lot of songwriting workshops.
I did.
And now you're given them. You have one that's coming up here in a couple weeks, and then you have another one in April.
Yeah, thank you for the segue there.
How about that? Smooth, wasn't it?
Yeah, no. Man, you might want to get a radio show or something.
Well, talk about that, because I've always... What can be taught and what can't be taught in a workshop?
Really good question. Really, really good question.
Good job, Scott. Good job.
Well, you can't teach talent, can you?
No.
I think that people with a desire, a deep, deep, deep desire to write songs, that desire is probably put there for a reason. There's something they need to say.
Mm-hmm.
And so my job as a teacher is to help them to figure out what it is they need to say, help get it out of them. I've been teaching now for 5 years. I taught for about 3 years with Daryl Scott.
Oh man.
We taught together in Costa Rica every Christmas. We, mm-hmm, bring people in from all over the world. Then we taught twice here in town at Scarrett Bennett,
okay,
together. And Daryl is just a phenomenal songwriter, an amazing singer, and probably one of the best guitar players in Nashville.
Yeah.
And he plays everything else too. He's just incredible. And one of the wonderful things that I learned teaching with Daryl was that a really, really important part of teaching is listening, which, the, you know, you hit that in the hour prior with American Young about listening.
Mm-hmm.
And so my job as a teacher is to really, really listen and to take pause and be respectful and try to figure out how to help a student articulate what they're trying to say.
Okay.
You know, I can teach the mechanical part, which is boring, you know, the rhyme scheme or the things about songwriting that are technical.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not real interested in that. And there's teachers who can teach that way better than me, and they're at Berklee College of Music. What I'm good at teaching is getting people to get to their truth. And I think that's what people need most help with anyway. Most of them can come in and play, okay? And like we already established, if you can play three chords, right, you're halfway there.
Right,
yeah.
You know, now get to the truth part. And so a lot of folks haven't had the amount of therapy and work that I've done to help me get to mine. So I bring a lot of those skills into a class as well.
So that's probably why you keep it, because there's only 20 in each class. So you keep it that small so you can spend that kind of time with each of them.
That's why we limit it to 20. So, okay. So Daryl's doing his own in May. I've branched out and I'm doing my own now. We did the first one sold out in 3 days.
Wow.
So I said, okay, well, let's add another one. So we're doing another one here in Nashville, April 24th, 25th, and 26th at Skerritt Bennett, which is a lovely, beautiful campus right off of Music Row. So people can stay over there. They have affordable rooms. I think it's like $67 for a nice room.
Okay.
And be on campus, and it's 3 days of intensive songwriting stuff. You know, you can find out about it at performingsongwriter.com. I've teamed up with Lydia from Performing Songwriter magazine, and she's good at the hospitality part, and she's good at the organization part, which takes the pressure off of me. I don't have to be organized or hospitable.
Excellent.
Perfect. All right. Well, listen, we need to take another quick break, but we're going to be back with more of Mary Gaucher here on the Music Row Show. All right, welcome back to the Music Row Show. We're here with Mary Gaucher, and that's a tune called Cigarette Machine. Off her brand new project, Live at Blue Rock.
Here it is. Put it right there.
Yeah, you can see that on the radio. It's beautiful.
Well, theater of the mind, I know.
Well, we're kind of running out of time. We would love to hear another song from you. You feel like...
I would love to play another song.
All right.
It sure is fun talking with you guys.
I'm glad you're here. Love it. We love that you're here.
Will you come back? Because we were just talking. There's so many other things we need to talk about.
I'd love to come back and talk about how up-and-comers and people who are getting started with songwriting can get started, how I've figured it out.
Yeah.
Perfect.
You know?
Love that.
Mm. She didn't get mad, she didn't even cry. She lit a cigarette and she said goodbye. I must have missed a sign, I missed a turn somewhere. I looked in her eyes, there was a strike. She's made, it's a natural fact. Once she's really gone, she can't come back. Ain't no wedding dress, ain't no band of gold gonna keep her there when a woman goes cold. You're no longer her concern. Scorched earth cannot burn. It's out of your control when a woman goes cold. She won't give an inch. She won't be convinced. Ain't no mercy in her soul when a woman goes cold. Thank you. she'd scream and shout. I wish she'd slam a door. I wish she'd curse my name like she did before. But she looks through me like I'm not there, and I'm dying here, and she just don't care. You're no longer her concern. Scorched earth cannot burn. It's out of your control. When a woman goes cold, she won't give an inch. She won't be convinced. Ain't no mercy in her soul when a woman goes cold.
That is amazing, amazing. Now you play a bunch in Europe. I read. How is that music scene different? How do they respond to you differently? Do you have to tailor your show differently for European audiences?
Well, it depends. What I've learned is that when it's an audience that English isn't the first language.
Yeah.
There's it comes down to television subtitles, quite frankly.
Okay.
In Germany, all the European countries run American shows.
Right.
Some countries overdub the American shows in German or Spanish or French, so the lips don't match, but they're running the American the English subtitles, but they're speaking in the native language, and those countries are a little less fluent in English than the ones who run the television shows in English.
Okay.
And run the Dutch subtitles. So, like in Holland, they speak English just as fluently as we do. I mean, they're bilingual English. In Sweden, same thing. And in Denmark, same thing. In Germany, not really. In Spain, not really. Italy, not really. So, the only real difference is when I'm speaking in between songs, slow it down a little.
Okay.
And if people are talking...
Right.
Don't take it personal because somebody's translating.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, again, and I want to just say this one more time. People go to performingsongwriter.com because the next song workshop is in April. I'm curious. Do you still have any slots available for the February?
February sold out.
Okay.
I probably have about eight slots left in April.
Okay.
April. Yeah, and we have some guests. Surprised guest songwriters come join us.
They're surprised to be there, or they're going to surprise them?
Sort of kidnap them and bring them over? Yeah.
Well, I'd like to announce who they are, but because my friends tour so much, I never quite know who's going to be around.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
And so, but I can guarantee you the guests that we're going to have come talk to the students are going to be very, very good songwriters.
Let me ask you something regarding these workshops. I'm just guessing you get stuff out of this, too. I mean, creatively.
Oh, yeah.
Tell me what you end up with creatively from this.
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, I end up with a new respect for the just the power of song. Mm-hmm. There'll be at least once a day where we cry, you know, and... Once again, you know, your first guest that came on before me talked about crying. When you get to the truth, you have a visceral reaction to that. Mm-hmm. The Dutch call it chicken skin, where the hair on your arms stands up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what I'm trying to get them to.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get there, it's an emotional release. And so, I always wind up with another level of amazement. At the beauty of creativity and how it is intimately related to the creator. I absolutely believe that songs come through us, not from us, at least the good ones.
Right.
Uh-huh.
The good ones come through us. Right. I can play a few that have come from me, and you'll politely clap and nothing will happen. But I think that creators are really plugged in to the big kahuna when great stuff flies through us. And I end up with a newfound joy for my chosen profession. You know, I'm so glad I'm not cooking anymore.
Yeah. Well, with that in mind, how important is rewriting in your process?
Actually, I think it should be called song rewriting. Mm-hmm. I think if you're going to get downright honest about songwriting, it's song rewriting.
Okay.
You know, it's about, you know, I use a cooking analogy because that was my profession.
Sure.
You know, if you're going to make a demi-glace, which is one of the finer sauces that you put on good meat, a demi-glace is an incredible sauce. But a demi-glace starts with 20 gallons of water and 50 pounds of bones. And you roast the bones and you put in celery and carrots and onions and red wine and you roast it and roast it and roast it. And you put that in that 20 gallons of water and you start boiling. And you boil 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 and you bring it down and bring it down and bring it down to where all that ends up with maybe, 10 cups. 10 cups out of 20 gallons and 50 pounds, and that's the good stuff.
Right.
And a tablespoon will do you. Well, truth is like that. A tablespoon will do you. But you got to boil it down to get to it. And so you just leave it simmering until you get there. Sometimes they come intact. You know, Towns Van Zandt dreamed if I needed you.
Yeah.
He woke up and had it. Wrote it and went back to sleep. Guy Clark said that he did that. He did. It happened at Guy's house, and I believe him.
Mary, look at my arm right there.
Got it.
Goosebumps. You just gave me goosebumps.
Yeah, man.
That's awesome.
A spoonful will do you.
Man, look at that.
Oh, man.
Woo! Hey. Thank you so much for hanging out with us. We've had a great time.
Oh, man, y'all got a cool show. Thanks for having me.
Thank Everybody you. Go to marygaucher.com. And that's spelled G-A-U-T-H-I-E-R, gaucher.com.
And performingsongwriter.com. There's 8 more spots for this workshop.
Yeah, and go get her project. It's called Live at Blue Rock. It's awesome. Hey, we'll see you next week on the Music Row Show. Strong.